This is the Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Bob Francis from Whitworth University. I'm here with Dr. Elizabeth Seal, professor of sociology at the State University of New York at Oneonta. Lizzie has published numerous articles on welfare, poverty, rural issues, gender, and health. Lizzie is joining me today to discuss her 2023 book, Understanding Poverty, A Relational Approach, which is the culmination of nearly two decades of research on poverty that has included hundreds of interviews and countless hours of volunteering at various kinds of organizations serving the poor. We're also joined today by my social stratification class here at Whitworth University. They have read Lizzie's book this semester and will bring some student voices into the conversation in a little bit. Lizzie, thanks for joining my class and for joining the Annex Sociology podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to start by giving you the opportunity to talk about the genesis of this book project. Where did your interest in poverty originally come from? And what was the journey that led to this particular book?
Right. When I was in graduate school and I was trying to decide what direction to go in, there's a lot of interest circulating around that time in the effects of the huge welfare reforms of the 1990s. One of my professors received a grant that included a research assistant, and that's where I began. Over time, I became more interested in the issue of how we view people in poverty and the tension between understanding the structural factors of poverty and the day-to-day experience of not only people in poverty, but also the service providers who are trying to help. The tricky issue is balancing an understanding of the truly insidious ways that inequality shapes people, with the tendency that human beings have to overgeneralize and stigmatize marginalized populations like people in poverty. So to put it another way, how do we understand the ways that people are damaged by poverty without blaming the victim? You know, can we go beyond this avoidance of blaming the victim to recognize that people in poverty have agency too? So to give a quick example, I had a discussion with a family planning community educator about a young woman who was pregnant with twins, struggling financially, and just absolutely depressed, becoming increasingly, you know, apathetic by the day. And we talked about how difficult it was to help this woman, but also about like how little control that she had over her own life. And how can we expect her to take control over her own life when she has virtually no experience of it? And it came to me later that part of the answer is to relate to her in such a way that does give her control, at least in that relationship, whenever one can. Personal agency, it has to be experienced and practiced relationally. Now, at the same time, I worry that if we put too much emphasis on personal agency, we might miss the power imbalances. So that's kind of how I came to see the value of thinking relationally. It's a relationship. A human being is a concerted effort. You know, our personhood is the outcome of relations with others. So that's where it began.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great introduction. And as a sociologist who studies poverty myself, as I read the book, I was really struck by this idea of a relational approach. So I'm wondering if you could say more about relationality, what it means in this context, and how you feel it might bring us a new perspective for understanding poverty.
Okay, so thinking relationally means considering other people involved in any encounter or action or decision made by someone. Yeah. Relational approaches basically take some outcome of interest, poverty itself, or the ability to, you know, if somebody to conduct family planning, we take that outcome as a relational achievement, you know, something that's produced through the relations of two or more individuals rather than an individual achievement, right? So rather than thinking of an outcome as like the product of an individual, they did that, they decided this, they ended up that. Considering other players, who else is involved? Who is this person acting for? Because our behavior is always in relation to others. Individuals always face consequences that are dependent on other people. And this doesn't happen in a vacuum, but in a web of relations and in the culture and structures that are formed by those webs, right? So when we try to understand individuals and take into account their realities, we need to remember that these are often situational, that they're formed and maintained in relation with others, and that sometimes it's not the individual characteristics we should try to change, but the relations. For instance, say a young mother over-disciplines her child. We can try to get her to manage her anger more effectively, educate her, But it might be just as important to change the fact that the relationship she has with other people continually disempower her. Perhaps the fact that she is solely responsible for the child, who maybe is a child who requires, you know, extra patience. You know, so there's that relation too. So perhaps she can be a better mother if we change those relationships that she has with other people. That sounds like a lot, I realize, but there are some fairly straightforward things that can be done to improve those relations. Like, you know, it could be something like a more stable job with predictable hours, a boss who isn't overcritical. You know, it could be a social worker who doesn't just penalize this mother, but, you know, explains that there are consequences for her actions with the child and then helps her find decent childcare. We don't want to permit child abuse. On the other hand, demonizing the mother, focusing on just punishing the mother is not going to be the best solution. You know, chances are she could be a much better mother if she has the opportunity to do so, just as she has to take responsibility for how she is forming this child and its future. So do we have to take responsibility for our relations that we form with her. This brings up a lot of issues. I realize, you know, the individual may be formed through relations with others, but conversely, that same individual has a responsibility to others. It goes both ways. We can never forget that. Part of what we do in relations with others is hold other people accountable. And that's important to do so in ways that encourage a sense of responsibility as opposed to traumatizing people. Withholding food, housing, or condemning someone to lifelong struggle is not going to, you know, help us create a better society.
Yeah, thank you. And maybe this is a bit of a follow-up to that question, but you write in the book, you have a line that says poverty is a social relation. And I'm wondering if you could say more just about how we might, again, understand poverty through this relational approach. And I'm also sort of thinking about, you haven't mentioned so far the role of institutions or organizations, you know, and we'll talk in a minute about this kind of structure culture dichotomy that's kind of a longstanding discussion in this field. But anyway, we'll start there with like unpacking this idea of poverty as a social relation.
So when I say social relation, I guess I'm talking about three different things. How we relate to one another, like cognitively and emotionally, our actual interactions and the relationships that are formed thereby, and the ways that a person, a group, or an institution affects another or is dependent on another. So poverty is a social relation because it exists in relation to non-poverty, right? Wealth. And what I learned from, you know, just extensive research and a lot of reading too, is that people in poverty experience relations with others that continuously disadvantage them further. So people in poverty experience these relations that continuously disadvantage them further, and this is endemic to poverty. So that's why I say poverty is a social relation. And these forms of disadvantage are not just monetary or physical. They may pay psychological dividends at social costs. You might feel better if you defend yourself to an authority figure, but you might have just made a powerful enemy. Or rather than admit that you don't have a laptop at home to work on this project for school, just act like you don't care about the assignment. Saves face, but the teacher thinks you're not a good student and that you just don't care. But sometimes people are in poverty because of lack of integration into society, because we don't like provide adequate healthcare, for instance. So that lack of integration is a lack of normal relations with important institutions. That's kind of at the extreme end, but you can think of like folks living with disabilities and not having that integration into institutions like the labor market, people living in rural areas, you know, without a lot of training opportunities or job prospects, or people with severe mental health issues, right, where you become really separated from normal relations with institutions. And because there's so many ways to be vulnerable in American society, there's a great deal of diversity among people in poverty. But what they have in common is that vulnerability. You know, the source of that vulnerability can vary quite a bit. But, you know, as I put it in the book, being poor means that all kinds of people can take advantage of you.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. So personally, as I read the book, I was really drawn to the ways that you seek to arbitrate between the structural and cultural explanations of poverty, which those of us who are poverty scholars, you know the long history of this discussion. And please correct me if anything I say here is wrong, or that you would disagree with. But I think you identify rightly that sociologists largely reject anything that feels at all like a culture of poverty approach. But I think you also note that there can be some times that we might, as poverty scholars, romanticize maybe poverty or people in poverty, or overlook variation in behavior among people in poverty or outcomes of people who experience poverty. Again, I'm reminded here of a recent article in 2021 in the Annual Review of Sociology that I think tries to rehabilitate this notion of socialization and social reproduction. And, you know, maybe we've gotten a little too far in the structural direction. That long intro to ask, you know, can you say more about how you think about this tension between structure and culture and how this relational approach that you're proposing might offer a way forward in this debate?
Yes, we miss much when we do not consider culture, including, you know, how people navigate structure and institutions and the many ways that we are formed socially. And many theorists have grappled with this, including, for instance, Pierre Bourdieu, whose work focused on resolving the tension between, you know, the macro and the micro, the structural and the cultural, determinism versus agency. In an article that I published in the American Sociologist, I wrote about this, pointing out that for a number of prominent sociological theories, the point is to see how and to what degree people in poverty may accept their inferiority, may internalize it, be socialized, and to understand their participation in the mechanisms, right, the social processes that disadvantage them. The relational approach provides greater context to people's perspectives and behaviors because we can see how these matter and how the actions and perspectives of others matter as well. It's not just this one person and what they're doing and what they think. But when discussions about people's perspectives or their behaviors, when these lack that contextualization, they're easily interpreted as being like intrinsic to the individual and thus pathologized. Really, you know, and the problem is viewed as being this individual thinks this way, or this individual has been socialized that way. And now this is how they are. I do think we should keep open the possibility that sometimes child poverty, for instance, may do lasting damage. As the author suggests in the article that you mentioned, we need to recognize when socialization does profoundly disempower people in the very ways that they approach life and experience it and how they relate to other people. I think taking the relational approach helped resolve my dilemma between recognizing those insidious methods, right, of perpetrating inequality in our very personhood while not blaming the victim or turning it into a pathology. I can give a quick example. Why does someone portray themselves on social media in a way that a potential employer might find objectionable? Because that person is not relating to their employers in that moment, or their potential employers in that moment on social media. They're trying to win the approbation of a different audience, or they might be trying to shore up an identity that has meaning to them. This isn't a new problem. It's a new manifestation, maybe, of how human beings do stupid things because it makes them feel good, right? It's not that Gen Z is uniquely stupid, right? No, the problem is these relations we have with our peers are becoming easier to scrutinize. The structure has changed, and we need to feel good, all of us, human beings, you know, regardless of our age or financial status. So structure and culture are both part of the story here. In this particular example, the culture of youth, the structure of technology, and we understand why an individual does something that renders a certain consequence by identifying the relations in which it occurs. I'm trying to get approbation from my peers. This is important to me. My potential employer is able to witness this, which I don't think about because that's a hypothetical action that takes place in a different context than the one I'm operating in, right? But it's one to which I am nonetheless kind of at the mercy of. But it's even more complicated because if the employer is desperate for workers, this is, you know, where the relational part comes in again. If the employer is desperate for workers, the power imbalance may not be that extreme. It might be that I get the job anyway because they really need somebody. So even the consequence depends on the relations that, you know, somebody has to like the labor market.
So there's a section in the last chapter of the book about changing our thinking about poverty, which seemed to me to be largely geared toward the ways in which the general public still remains stuck in, as you've already talked about, some individualistic understandings of poverty that blame people in poverty for their circumstances and pathologize their behavior. So assuming that most sociologists who read your book maybe don't share those views, especially poverty scholars, I wonder if there are ways that you think that sociologists, or and maybe poverty scholars in particular, also could use a change in thinking about poverty based on either the relational approach or just your own research and experience in this field.
I believe sociologists just need to be more deliberate in their relationality, in making relationality a greater part of A, how they conduct research, and B, how they explain that research, as in like the classroom, especially. I don't think we're always getting the right message across. We often do talk about outcomes at the individual level, or, you know, characteristics, demographics, right? But we know these are not essential characteristics as sociologists, but too often I think we kind of fall into the trap, whether it's methodologically or theoretically, of kind of reifying culture or structure or the individual. So like race, for example, when we think about race and we measure it this way and we analyze it this way as a characteristic of an individual, right? Yes, we learn something important about that individual, but we need to remember that race only matters relationally. It's not an immutable, inherent part of an individual. And race is going to mean something different, right? Depending upon who you're interacting with. Same thing with poverty, class, right? And so on. Sociologists know this, but we still tend to rely on methodological individualism. That just means understanding people as individuals, measuring characteristics of individuals, and kind of neglecting the relational aspects of life. Or we also sometimes go in the other direction and give society too much power. And it's partly a matter of convenience, admittedly, in terms of measurement, but it does reinforce the tendency to interpret research in these kind of overly simplistic ways. We can think about the research on risk, identifying risk factors so that we can identify problems. In this research, we're often looking at what factors increase the likelihood, right, of some negative outcome, like, you know, high school dropout or child neglect. Okay. And researchers tend to identify characteristics that are viewed as belonging to the individual or the family, such as being a single parent household, having a depressive parent, or, you know, looking at economic resources. But the larger context in which these characteristics are risks and under what circumstances they are risks, that tends to be only covered in passing or just kind of ignored altogether as like outside the scope of the study. I would like us to be more proactive in data collection that provides more kind of in-depth knowledge and really broad exposure to research subjects and situations, recognizing that, you know, people are not always going to act the same. They don't always even believe the same things depending on their audience. Right. So interpretation of data that includes situational, relational features of the behavior of people in poverty, I think that will decrease the tendency to individualize the problems of poverty. We can observe relations. And I think in the process of analyzing those observations of relations, that's also when the structural and cultural tends to come to our attention. We don't always have the language to talk relationally. In our language, we tend to give agency to either individuals or society, right? Society tells us this, teaches us this, it prevents us from doing this. The individual does this, right? So it can be a struggle sometimes to maintain that lens, but that's why we kind of have to be, I think, so deliberate in doing so. I mean, it's something that, you know, I try to work hard at myself.
Yeah, thank you. There's a lot in there that I look forward to continued conversation. So I have two more questions before we turn it over to the students. The first of the questions is, I think you make two important points in writing about the relation. I mean, more than two, of course, but two that I'm going to highlight here, two points about the relational nature of poverty. First, that the poor themselves are not homogenous. And in fact, many of us will experience poverty, or certainly will know people who do. And the second is that the relational nature of poverty, by definition, implicates those of us who are not currently poor. And the second point makes me think of a key point in Matt Desmond's recent book, Poverty by America, where he suggests one of the major reasons why there's so much poverty in the United States is because that many of us who are not in poverty currently benefit from the existing arrangement, whether we are willing to admit that or not. So I'm wondering if you would agree with Desmond's point, and if you have any other thoughts for those of us who are not currently poor and how we might be implicated in the kind of current arrangement of things and how we might be called on to respond.
I'm going to go out on a limb a little bit here and kind of depart from what I focus on in the book, which is grounded in evidence, but to just say that I think we need to be more forgiving and more generous when it comes to what policies we support. I might think that it's not fair for me to have to pay taxes to cover someone else's childcare. They decided supposedly to have a child, not me. Okay. but I'm going to pay one way or the other, whether I like it or not, right? Either now or later on in having to direct funds toward, you know, remedial education or social rehabilitation, incarceration, addiction, or whatever. You know, I think that we have to ask ourselves, what kind of society do we want to live in? One where you can trust people most of the time and not be fearful of other people, to be able to enjoy people going about their business, you know, making awesome stuff and doing wonderful things? Or do you want a society where people resent each other, where people are always afraid, where we are always concerned about getting ripped off? This isn't really about poverty. It's about the fact that we are interdependent, whether we like it or not. That other person's child is my responsibility, and I am going to be theirs at some point because we have to live together. And we benefit in the short term from being stingy and judgmental. Yes, you could argue, I think, and there are definitely ways that we benefit in the short term, but I seriously question whether we benefit in the end. It is hard caring about other people. It means you have to pay attention, hold politicians accountable, but I think the effort's worth it. And I would say to a lot of my own students is start where you can. Don't try to go from, you know, never reading the news to feeling bad that you don't read the news every day and then giving up, right? Work into it gradually. Give yourself time to mature into it. You also can't make yourself solely responsible for any one person, let alone any group of people. You know, you have to live your life too. Research has shown that if you want to keep guilt from interfering with your ability to empathize, you also have to give yourself a break sometimes. But just don't opt out because it seems too overwhelming. So that's kind of what I would say. I mean, there's more I could talk about in terms of the relations by which we benefit from poverty. A lot of people have written about that probably in more interesting ways than I have, because, you know, there are, at least in the short term. But again, I would question about whether in the long term it's worth it for us as, you know, as a whole. At a more personal or maybe like concrete level, I suggest the next time you have a close encounter with a homeless person, ask them their name, right? You don't have to give them money, just respect. Just as like a little, you know, piece of homework, right? A little challenge for you. Like, what can I do? How can I change my relations with others in such a way to influence poverty? And I think that anytime you treat people with respect, they are more likely to respect themselves.
Thanks for the homework for the class.
Sorry, I didn't mean to come across as preachy. I also think that sometimes it's good to have a little something kind of concrete like that too. And in something interpersonal, right?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And it actually, you wouldn't have known this, but another book that we read in this course on social stratification is Robert Putnam's Our Kids. And, you know, the idea behind the title is exactly what you articulated, is that, you know, we want to move back to a society or a culture where we see all kids as ours and not just this kind of rat race. And in some ways, I struggle with this because, of course, as a parent myself, I think most parents aren't trying to be neglectful of others, but they're doing their best for their families and their, you know, the people close to them, their communities, how they understand, you know, their tribe, so to speak. But then you aggregate up all those decisions and then you end up with residential segregation by race and class and all these other seemingly intractable challenges, you know, that I still don't have great answers from a policy perspective. I'm a little dubious that we can just rely on the goodwill of the fortunate, you know, out of their own benevolence, you know, to acquiesce to some of the things maybe that might be needed in something like zoning laws. How we get from here to there is still a bit of a challenge in my mind. So my last question before I turn it over to a few students is that, although you mentioned COVID a few times in the book, I suspect that COVID and its aftermath were largely not part of your writing of the book, and even, of course, especially the research that led up to the book. So I'm just curious from your perspective about what developments there have been regarding poverty in the U.S. since the book was finished, like COVID or not COVID related, and how the book might help us understand some of that.
Right. Yeah. We didn't know much yet about the mid or long-term impacts of the pandemic when I finished writing the book. On one hand, many people who were struggling financially before the pandemic, then they had to deal with overcrowding in the home, the risk of illness and death, oftentimes a higher risk of illness and death. And sometimes not having the luxury of working from home, having to interact with the public a lot, further heightening that risk, sometimes losing their job or their business. On the other hand, there were a lot of types of government assistance during the pandemic. And poverty, as measured by the SPM, that's the supplemental poverty measure, with the SPM, poverty decreased to around 8% nationally. The lowest ever. This is when we measure it a certain way. We measure poverty that in a way that includes not just income, but like non-cash assistance, food aid, you know, we also take into account certain expenses and cost of living considerations, right? So it gets more to the level of like hardship than income. During the pandemic, you know, the federal and some state governments gave people childcare subsidies, their cash payments, increases in food aid, extensions on unemployment compensation. Recall there were moratoriums on eviction. Many of the homeless were placed in motel and hotel rooms, right? And that's not to say that we solved all the problems of poverty. We also faced increased costs for some goods and services and in a shortage of labor, but child poverty decreased to 5%. 5%. Food insecurity decreased, especially for families with children. Since then, the SPM has gone back up, right? So since those various forms of assistance have expired, a lot of those benefits have expired. So looking at 2022 data, the SPM increased by, I think it was 4.6% nationally. So I think what the pandemic showed is that, one, we can't eliminate poverty. At least we can at least do much better than our normal. And two, we don't have equitable healthcare access in this country. And people have drastically different chances at a long, healthy life. But it's interesting because when we recognized as a country or politically that people are vulnerable right now and they deserve assistance to help them get through crisis, we were able to help a lot of people. Not everyone to the degree that they would have liked. But poverty was easy. The poverty part, it was keeping small business owners afloat. That was the bigger problem. But expanding food assistance, that was no problem. And that's why I harp so much in part on recognizing that many of us are vulnerable to poverty and that many of the problems faced by the poor extend beyond them because we do all benefit. That doesn't mean there won't be costs or sacrifices. You know, prices tend to go up when we pay people higher wages. But if the increase in price actually goes to workers, big if, we have fewer social problems to make up for in the long run.
Well said, and thank you. So now I want to turn to the students in the room. So our first question comes from Neeraj, and I will turn it over to him.
Hello, I'm Neeraj. Thank you for being here. Thank you for writing that book. It has been very insightful, and we've enjoyed reading it over the semester. In the light of the answer you just gave, like, I think this is very relevant in the sense that it seems like we make strides, like the NGOs and governments make strides, but we kind of regress for some reason. So what would you say would be the primary challenge NGOs or the government face in providing, and now I guess retaining, meaningful support to people in poverty?
Thank you for that question, Neeraj. I would say trying to actually partner with people in poverty rather than treating them as objects of charity. The word has gotten out that this is the way to do things, but I'm not sure funding models and operations have adapted. It can also be difficult to work with people in poverty, you know, when you expect more of them than they can give. Because if you are trying to help people, you know, and your relationship with them matters, and if you're trying to improve their life, you know, you need to treat them as an active participant in that. But they may not be as free in their other relations, you know. So getting a mother in poverty to leave an abusive partner, for instance, you know, so to be able to work around that dynamic, that can be challenging. A bit more about the structural aspect. A lot of funding comes with strings attached. People who are giving the money typically want to make sure it's going to people who really need it, which makes sense, but that places limits on what NGOs and governments can do. And so concerns about proper documentation can really pervert the goal of helping people, right? The goal becomes about the documentation, because in order to help the people, you got to get the funding, but in order to get and keep the funding, you got to do the documentation. And so a lot of times in like social services, there's so much focus on preventing people from taking advantage and making sure that everything's documented that it kind of works against the whole point. So I would say those two things.
Thank you. And our next question is from Avis.
I am Avis. Thank you for being here. So I'm just wondering, in chapter 4 of the book, you mentioned that the culture of poverty thesis has gained some academic credibility in the past. And I was just wondering what implications this has for the field of sociology, especially as it studies poverty.
Academic sociologists have been realizing that structure doesn't explain everything. It's an important part, but it doesn't explain everything. And there's been some really good research looking at how people in poverty make meaning in their lives and how that affects what they do. I also personally just appreciate disagreement or contestation in the field versus all of us thinking alike. So having more conservative pushback against these ideas about poverty is important, I think, because it helps us think better and more clearly if we engage with challenges to our ideas. So I think this is largely a good thing, but we do have to do two things. One is we have to avoid overgeneralizing. We have to avoid talking about a single culture of poverty. There is no culture of poverty as such that is widespread. There may be cultures of poverty. I'm not even sure we want to call them of poverty. There's also a difference, I think, between studying, trying to understand cultural issues among people in poverty and arguing that there's a problematic culture of poverty, right? The two are not synonymous. You don't have to believe there's a problematic culture of poverty to try to better understand culture among people in poverty, right? And I kind of think if we avoid that altogether, we're kind of doing them a disservice. You know, is culture something that we can only study among, you know, elites? So I do agree that overall this return to culture is good. Let's just not make the same mistakes, right, that we made before with culture of poverty.
Thank you. And our next question is from Chris.
Hello, I'm Chris. I think this is my third class with Dr. Francis now. And something me and Niraj, we always ask, like, what is the solution? we always get like these discussions and, you know, problems, but we always try and figure out what a solution would be. So I think you'd be the person to ask for this. In terms of poverty, like, what do you see as the largest issue and what, like, feasible solution would you have to it?
Yeah, it's hard to pick one, Chris, because there are so many sites of vulnerability. You know, lack of adequate housing really stands out, but that's an issue that affects many people right now beyond just the poor. Healthcare access would be another point of intervention. But what I've been thinking more about recently is the role of the criminal justice system. This is also where I think attitudes toward poverty can make a difference. So I would say decriminalization of the homeless. Protect the homeless as opposed to viewing them as the criminals. I know that the police are often doing what they are expected to do or told to do. It is unfortunate that the criminal justice system ends up having to clean up a lot of the messes of society. So if you think about it, if we don't address social problems in some other way, think of like substance abuse, mental health, young people lacking hope or job options, even unauthorized immigration. If we don't address those some other way, what institution ends up dealing with it? It always comes back to the criminal justice system. And it's a lot to ask of our criminal justice system. I think that's partly why it fails so much. Nonetheless, the criminalization of like the homeless is something that's increasingly coming not from police officers or prosecutors. It's coming from politicians, local government, and in-housed citizens more and more. There are many, many ways that the criminal justice system penalizes people in poverty and actually keeps them in debt and vulnerable to exploitation that could be easily changed through policy. So we're talking about there some pretty straightforward solutions if only enough people with power care about it or are made to care about it. That's where I would take it.
That's great, Lizzie. And now we have a question from Sydney.
So I'm Sydney, and I'm really interested in the intersectionality between psychology and poverty. And I was just wondering if you thought that making mental health resources accessible to low-income families could create a positive change in upward mobility.
Sydney, I think there's a lot of power in combining psychological and sociological perspectives to understand people. So thank you. And I do think mental health among people who struggle financially is absolutely a critical issue. I suspect that the relationship between poverty and mental health really goes both ways and they reinforce each other. Research shows, for instance, that when you give single mothers in poverty better nutritional options and you basically solve that issue of food insecurity, their mental health improves. And then their relations with their kids improve. You know, mental health profoundly impacts our relations with others. It can be an additional vulnerability, right, that prevents any chance of improving one's life. So yes, this is an area where we desperately need improvement, but our mental health system is in crisis right now. So I think it will take a lot of work. And we don't want to turn poverty into a pathology of the individual, right? We need to remember, if anything, it's a pathology of society. It's a problematic social relation imposed on people. And mental health issues are not just an issue for people at the lower socioeconomic levels. But maybe when you're struggling with poverty, the impact of your mental health is greater. The consequences of being depressed may be greater. The benefits of being able to focus on your own well-being and that of your family may be greater. People in poverty, you have to deal with more stresses that are kind of like life and death, housed or not housed, eat or don't eat, right? Kinds of issues. So definitely a lot of interesting intersections there.
So are there any other questions from students who are here?
So you talk a lot about how someone's predicament, someone's situation, them being in poverty, of course, is a relational issue, that there is a bigger picture behind why they're mm-hmm. there, right? And you also laid out the general consciousness regarding this issue is that like people really individualize. What would you say to a person like to kind of change their mind about this? Would you just present their evidence? Because the I've also taken like 3 classes with Dr. Francis, and this evidence seems to be really prevalent. Like you got to look at a person in their environment rather than themselves. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be a lot of emphasis on autonomy. So how would you mm-hmm. change people's mind, I guess, or change their view? What approach would you take?
That's a difficult one, but a great question, because I think a lot of us would like to know the answer. I guess, you know, one thing that I've done in the past is just point out that people have to have a chance to practice autonomy. If they're going to be autonomous, if they're going to take control over their lives, they need some kind of practice doing that. And not all of us have that privilege of actually understanding and experiencing control over our own life. Some of us actually live under an illusion that we have more control than we actually do. But there are some people who just never had that experience. You can't just say, oh, well, if I were in this person's shoes, I would not be where they're at. There are a lot of people, I think, in poverty, but also not in poverty, who just act in ways that, you know, are difficult to tolerate. And you just think you're hurting yourself by acting this way. And we all think that, right? I mean, about people at some point in time. What we tend to forget is people only have the resources they have. And there's a reason why they're limited in that. And there's no simple way to understand people. You know, I wish I had like a pat little answer for that I could just roll out, you know, and say, yeah, well, you know, this is how human psychology or sociology really works. But it's about really just developing and practicing your own sense of empathy too, maybe, and saying to people, well, you know, do you ever make a mistake and have to pay such a high price for it that this, you know, so this person's making a mistake, but why should they have to pay such a steep price for it? And that's about the best I can do.
Thank you.
Thank you. We got some nods there with your last. Anyone else have questions? Oh, yeah. Kel.
Hi, my name is Keller. I was curious about the last phrase in your book. It reads, all are implicated, all are affected. And I'm curious why you chose that to be your send-off phrase for your book. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Keller, was it?
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to kind of end with giving people a sense of that responsibility for others and that realization that we're not isolated. You know, this is not somebody else's problem. Poverty is not something that we can just ignore or pretend isn't there, because we are implicated and we're also all vulnerable. I mean, a lot of us think it's never going to happen to me, but it's sometimes scary. In interviewing people, you know, I would come across people who are like, you know, I used to be like you. You know, there's all types of people in poverty. And when some people are vulnerable, in a way, we all are vulnerable. So we really need to kind of keep that in mind. And I wanted to in the book on that, you can't just pretend it's not a problem or that your actions don't matter. Thanks. Great question. All very good questions.
Yes, they did great. Anyone else have a question? Well,
was there anything?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
If I may, what was most surprising or what resonated the most with you while reading or discussing the book? Is there anything that kind of like really resonated or that you found particularly surprising?
For me, I found your book to be very, like Dr. Francis put it, it's like a big literature review of like mm-hmm. everything that a lot of things that has to do with poverty, but you keep on bringing it back in a very human place, I think, which is lacking in a lot of like research-based books, I guess. Like the relational approach, I really appreciated it. I kept on finding myself saying, that is so true. That is, it is a very one-to-one almost relational thing that we are and they are. And like everything is sort of relationally interconnected. One thing I thought about was like, when we look at a person in a very precarious situation on the streets doing drugs, you kind of now see that so many human things have gone wrong in this person's life. Like there have been so many relational almost miscarriages that have happened in this person's life to for them to have like reached at this point, and in America too, which is so crazy. I really like that about your book.
Thank you. Yeah, that's interesting. Like I said, it's not always simple. The more you practice it, you know, the more you think relationally, the easier it gets. You know, and it's not always like, oh, wait, what am I supposed to do again?
I think we have another comment. Go ahead, Keller.
I think the thing that resonated with me the most in the book was that it humanized poverty and kept the humanity of the people that are experiencing it in the center of the book, rather than having it be like a political type statistic that we're trying to solve.
I wish I had that blurb on the book. That's exactly what I was trying to go for. I mean, to be honest, I wanted to humanize it, yeah, and not just make it about how to maintain your liberal credentials, but about connections with other people and being able to feel that and see these are real people. Some of them are jerks, but some of them are really funny and really smart, and some of them are so kind, and some of them work so hard and are just, you know, I don't want to romanticize either, because there's definitely a lot of variation in everything, but just trying to humanize, I think, is a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of also the dynamic nature. I mean, you're kind of alluding to this, that I mean, we need to really resist thinking of people in poverty as some homogenous, as you said earlier, it's not a culture, but also it's not the same people. Most people's experiences with poverty are relatively short, and they don't, you know, chronic poverty is a different subset of folks. And I know my own research on labor force participation kind of shows this too, that our lives are all in constant movement. And yeah, and so just to to kind of snapshot or freeze frame someone's life at a particular moment in time really loses the relational aspect that you're talking about. And I've really been challenged in reading your book about bringing in that relational component. I mean, you have some compelling, I think, anecdotes at the very beginning talking about the two people, you know, the first two people and figuring out social relations, and just the fact that without, you know, poverty requires wealth and it requires people. I mean, it's like Mead's looking glass self, that like, in a sense, there's no self without others. We need others to reflect back. And so with poverty too, or any social status or social relation. So anyway, there's a lot of food for thought for me and my work. I look forward to continuing to mull this over.
I just want to thank you all for taking the time to read the book, to come to class today and participate. That means a lot to me to have people engaging with these ideas. It's such a privilege for me to be here. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And you know, thanks for joining the class. And also thanks for allowing, and to the class too, allowing this conversation to be part of the Annex Sociology Podcast world. And we look forward to hearing our voices in that venue.
Awesome. Great.
You've been listening to the Annex, a sociology podcast. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Seal from the State University of New York at Oneonta. Dr. Seal is author of Understanding Poverty, a Relational Approach, published in 2023 by Polity Press. Appreciation goes to Dr. Robert Francis of Whitworth University and his students for hosting the conversation. Thanks also to our producer, to Joe Cohen, who directs the Queen's Podcast Lab. Thanks to Lena Orsa for the music. We'll see you next time.